Chapter 46. Libel. The attractive girl who stood in the witness box described how she had called at the consulting rooms of the famous surgeon and how he had asked her if he could look at a scar on her throat. He fastened his hand somewhat roughly between the ribbon that was on my neck and my throat. I said, "Oh, you're suffocating me," and he said, "Yes, I will, I can't help it." And then she lost consciousness. The famous advocate, Isaac Butt, asked her, "Are you now able to state whether in that interval of unconsciousness your person was violated?" Dropping her head, the girl whispered, "Yes." Butt wanted to make sure the jury got the point. "And was it?" Again she whispered, "Yes." And as the court broke into a buzz of excitement, the judge adjourned for the day. The girl's name was Moll Travers, daughter of a professor of Trinity College, Dublin, and the doctor who was accused of throttling her into unconsciousness and then deflowering her was the famous surgeon Sir William Wilde. The reader might be forgiven for assuming he was on trial for rape. In fact, he was not on trial at all. It was his wife who was being tried for libel, for writing an angry letter to the girl's father, accusing her of trying to blackmail her husband. This is the disappointing thing about libel trials. There's something absurdly trivial about most of them. We find great criminal trials exciting because they usually involve a confrontation of good and evil. Libel trials seldom involve anything more exciting than stupidity and malice. The Wilde scandal was no exception. Sir William Wilde may have been one of Ireland's most eminent eye surgeons, but he wasn't much liked. To begin with, he looked peculiar, with bulging eyes, a sensual mouth, and a receding chin. Photographs give him a certain resemblance to Groucho Marx, says Dr. Hugo Z. Hackenbush. His skin looked greasy and unwashed. There was a joke in Dublin, "Why are Sir William Wilde's nails so black?" And the answer, "Because he scratched himself." A more scurrilous story alleged that he had taken out a patient's eyes in the course of an operation and put them on the table. While he was looking for some surgical instrument, the cat jumped onto the table and ate them. In spite of his unprepossessing appearance, Wilde had vitality, humour, and tremendous drive, all characteristics that are admired by young women, and in the days when he was steadily establishing himself as Ireland's finest ear and eye surgeon, he had many mistresses, and fathered a considerable number of illegitimate progeny. One of these mistresses was a young girl whom he cured of deafness, May Josephine Travers, the daughter of a professor of law at Trinity. She also bore him a child, but Wilde felt no more inclination to marry her than any of the other girls he'd slept with. Besides, he already had a wife. In the year 1848, a young girl had made a stir throughout Ireland. Her name was Jane Francesca Elgee, and her patriotic verses, published under the name of Speranza, Hope, had already made her famous when she interrupted the trial of a newspaper editor with a shout of, "I alone am the culprit! I wrote the offending articles!" As a result, the editor of The Nation was acquitted on a charge of printing seditious libels. When Sir William Wilde met the tall, strikingly handsome girl not long after the trial, he knew that he had at last met a woman who was his intellectual equal. They were married in 1851 and had two children, one of whom, Oscar Fingal O'Flaherty Wills Wilde, would become famous as the author of The Importance of Being Earnest. Now, whether or not Wilde had really taken Molly Travers' virginity when she was under chloroform, as she alleged, she was certainly infatuated with her seducer, and bitterly angry when he broke with her. She brooded on getting her own back, and soon thought of a way. When Wilde gave a lecture at the Metropolitan Hall, small boys in the foyer gave away copies of a pamphlet entitled Florence Boyle Price. The pamphlet told the story of how an innocent young girl had gone to the surgery of a certain Dr. Quilp, obviously Wilde, and had been chloroformed by him and then ravished. The pamphlet added insult to injury by claiming to be written by Speranza. The real author, of course, was Moll Travers. The affair was the talk of Dublin, but the Wildes had the sense to ignore it. If they had continued to do so, all would have been well, but when, a few weeks later, Lady Wilde found an urchin selling the penny pamphlet in her own hallway, she indignantly snatched one and carried it off. The neurotic Miss Travers immediately summoned Sir William and Lady Wilde to court for non-payment of one penny. Neither had to appear, and presumably they paid the penny, but Lady Wilde now made the mistake of writing an angry letter to Professor Travers about the disreputable conduct of his daughter. This was all Moll Travers needed. She immediately had Lady Wilde served with a writ for libel, claiming £2,000 in damages. The case was heard in December 1864, and Miss Travers got what she wanted, the fullest publicity for her affair with Sir William Wilde. Her advocate, Sergeant Armstrong, told the jury of the rape again. This time it was not chloroform that subdued her, but strangulation. The result was the same. The sergeant explained sadly that she went in a maid, but out a maid never departed more. The story was probably neurotic invention. The flat truth was that Wilde was a philanderer and had seduced his patient because she was a pushover. He had been seen a great deal with her in public, and she often came to his house. Wilde's wife was indifferent to the affair. She had already developed an illness that made her hands and feet swell to elephantine proportions and had a number of eccentricities, such as staying in bed and receiving all visitors, even on the sunniest days, with the curtains drawn and the room lit by candles. One day, Moll Travers tried to visit Lady Wilde in her bedroom and was indignantly ejected. From then on, Sir William began to lose interest in her. Finally, at his wife's instigation, he refused to see her. And then the trouble began. It was an absurd trial and should have gone in Lady Wilde's favour. Her letter to Professor Travers was not libellous, but both she and her husband made errors of judgment that seriously alienated the jury. Lady Wilde was asked why she had not replied to a letter from Miss Travers telling her of her husband's attempt at rape. She replied coldly, "I took no interest in the matter," giving the impression that she was snobbish and heartless. And Sir William Wilde made things worse by deciding not to appear in the witness box to rebut the charges. The jury felt that this was cowardly and may have been angry at being cheated of more scandal. They ended by awarding Moll Travers a farthing in damages, but decided that Lady Wilde should pay the costs, several thousand pounds. A Dublin story insists that Sir William Wilde crossed the court and slapped a penny in front of Miss Travers, saying, "There's the price of your virtue. Now give me my change." But strangely enough, the verdict broke Wilde. He lost all his old fire. Although only 49 at the time of the trial, he seemed to become an old man. He lacked fighting spirit. A failing shared by his son Oscar. Oscar's downfall was also incurred through a libel case, although on this case Wilde was the plaintiff and the defendant was the Marquis of Queensberry, the father of Lord Alfred Douglas, who had accused Wilde of homosexual misconduct with his son. Wilde was guilty of this and was unwise to have brought the case. Queensberry turned the tables on him by simply proving that Wilde was a homosexual. This is a point worth noting about the law of libel, and one of those typical paradoxes that makes a character in Dickens say, "the law is an ass." A libel or slander is not made less libelous by the fact that it happens to be true. On the other hand, if a defendant can prove in court that his libel was true, he has a very good chance of being acquitted. It would be wrong to give the impression that all libel cases have been trivial. Some of the early ones have been concerned with vital liberties, and one of them gave us a number of great novels, including Robinson Crusoe and Moll Flanders. This was the trial in 1703 of a rather dubious political journalist named Daniel Foe, who had changed his surname to Defoe. Despite the fact that he became a great novelist, Defoe was not a particularly edifying character. He began his career as a writer of pamphlets. When the unpopular William of Orange came to the English throne, Defoe saw his opportunity and wrote a series of pamphlets praising and defending the Dutch king. As a result, he was awarded a government post and became, according to his own account, a close friend of the king's. But when William died in 1702, Defoe landed himself in hot water. He had been born into a family of dissenters, that is to say, people who did not agree with either the Protestants or the Catholics. The dissenters were much disliked in that age of religious controversy, although William of Orange had allowed them to take public office, provided they were willing to attend a Church of England service. However, after William's death, a group of extreme reactionaries began to advocate harsher measures against dissenters, that they should be banned from public office. These reactionaries were known as High Flyers, because they were so rigid about their principles. Defoe rather agreed with them that dissenters should not be allowed to take public office, largely because he thought that any dissenter who would attend a Church of England service must be a coward and a weakling anyway. By way of livening things up, he wrote a satirical pamphlet called The Shortest Way with Dissenters, arguing that they should all be banished or hanged. He was guying the reactionary cause by taking it to an extreme. But the result was unfortunate, for many of the high flyers took the pamphlet seriously, and one clergyman said he valued it above all books except the Bible. The dissenters were naturally deeply disturbed, imagining that a pogrom against them was about to break out. When it turned out that Defoe was the author of the tract, and that it was intended to be a satire, the high flyers were enraged. Parliament issued a warrant accusing Defoe of libelling the high flyers by making them out to be bloodthirsty maniacs. Defoe went into hiding, but finally he had to give himself up. In July 1703, he was sentenced to stand in the pillory for 3 days and to be detained during the Queen's pleasure. To Defoe's delighted astonishment, the scandal made him. Crowds came and cheered at the pillory, and he was lucky. Unpopular criminals were sometimes stoned to death. He was then sent to Newgate Prison for a year and was regarded as a national hero and martyr. He launched his first newspaper in jail, and it was an instant success, and his meetings with thieves and prostitutes gave him the basic material for novels like Moll Flanders, Captain Singleton, and Colonel Jack. It turned him from a dishonest journalist into a great novelist. In America, just over 30 years later, a similar case had equally important results, and is regarded as a milestone in the history of civil liberties. The villain of this piece was William S. Cosby, who had been appointed by the King of England to the post of Governor of the Crown Colony of New York. Cosby was utterly corrupt. In fact, he had lately been removed from his old post of Governor of Minorca for misappropriation of funds, only to have this new plum offered to him by the government. It was Cosby's belief that he was there to make as much money as possible from this sinecure. His predecessor in New York died in 1731. Cosby spent 13 months getting to America, having a final fling in Europe. When he finally did arrive in the New World, the New York Assembly voted him an excellent salary of £1,500 a year, a generous one considering that it had to come from the pockets of the taxpayers, and that America was not at that time very thickly populated. The settlers had heard that their new governor was bad-tempered, despotic, and greedy. Possibly the generous salary was meant to appease him. If so, it failed. The new governor promptly pointed out that they owed him £1,500 or so in back salary, and he ordered his tax collector, a widely respected Dutchman called Van Dam, to collect it for him. Van Dam firmly declined. Cosby then thought of an ingenious way of laying his hands on the taxpayers' money. He declared the judges of the Supreme Court, of which he himself was one, should have sole authority to hear cases involving finances. A similar trick had cost Charles I of England his head, but Cosby got away with it. One judge, Lewis Morris, ruled against him, and Cosby promptly sacked him. Two of Morris's ex-associates, James de Lancey and Frederick Phillips, were more obliging, and they were appointed to the bench. Cosby now had the state's legal system taped and was prepared to take on all comers. The first comer was Lewis Morris. He ran for the Assembly at Eastchester. Cosby tried bribery and trickery to make sure that he lost, but it was no good. The citizens elected Morris. And then Morris, together with Van Dam and a remarkable planter called James Alexander, began to plot Cosby's overthrow. A young German reporter called John Peter Zenger wrote an article about the Eastchester elections for his paper, The Weekly Gazette, describing in detail how Cosby had tried to intimidate voters. His editor not only declined to print it, but sacked Zenger. Morris, Van Dam, and Alexander immediately offered Zenger the money and support to start his own rival newspaper, the Weekly Journal. The first number appeared in November 1733, and it lost no time in making it clear that it considered Cosby to be a parasite and a crook. The full story of the battle against Cosby is too long to relate in detail. Van Dam and his friends pursued a kind of guerrilla campaign. Scandalous anti-Cosby songs were circulated, and even though Cosby offered £20 reward for the names of the authors, no one came forward. He tried to get grand juries to return an indictment against the virulency of the Journal's attacks, but they declined. De Lancey had another try in October 1734 with as little success. Cosby ordered that 4 issues of the Journal were to be burned at the hands of the public hangman in front of the mayor and the corporation, but the alderman refused to attend, and the papers had to be burned by a Negro servant. Finally, on November the 17th, 1734, Zenger was arrested and charged with publishing seditious libels. It should be noted that publishing doesn't necessarily mean to print. It simply means to make public, even by showing it to a neighbour. A bail of £800 was set to make sure that Zenger could not get out of jail. And since the judge on this case would be Delancey, Cosby was reasonably certain that there should not be too much difficulty. James Alexander and his close associate and fellow conspirator William Smith said they would be Zenger's attorneys. Cosby countered that move by having their names struck off the roll of attorneys, although he had no legal right to do so. It was pure dictatorial tyranny. Alexander and Smith decided they had to be more cautious, and so they made secret approaches to one of the great attorneys, Andrew Hamilton of Philadelphia. Hamilton was then a man of 59 suffering from gout. His first response to their approach was to name a very high fee. They decided it was worth it, and they proved to be right. Hamilton and Alexander carefully plotted their plan of campaign. The trial opened on August the 4th, 1735, by which time Zenger had been in jail for nearly a year. The Attorney General, Richard Bradley, was hoping to prove that Zenger had published the libels and had been therefore largely responsible for them. His first intimation that things were not going to go his way occurred when Andrew Hamilton walked into the court. If he had known sooner that Zenger was to be represented by a man as distinguished as Hamilton, Cosby would have found some way of disqualifying him. But at such short notice it was out of the question, and Hamilton immediately lived up to his reputation by admitting that his client had personally printed the libelous material and that his allegations were justified by truth. This dismayed Bradley, who had summoned an array of witnesses to prove that Zenger was the printer. Hamilton had taken the wind out of his sails. Bradley now tried another trick. He declared that since Zenger had admitted the charges, the jury only had to find him guilty. Hamilton, calm and magisterial, replied that this was not so. The words themselves had to be found to be libelous. Bradley cited many cases in which the libel had been found worse because it was true. Hamilton replied gently that he could not agree that just complaints of the people against a bad administration were a libel. The judge, Delancey, obviously agreed with Bradley. After a magnificent final speech from Hamilton, he summed up in a manner that was meant to bully the jurors. He told them that the facts of which Zenger stood accused had been confessed. As to the question of whether they were a libel, well, they could leave that matter to the court. He was intent on convincing them that their job was simply to bring in a verdict of guilty, and to make it more certain, he insisted that the question they had to decide was simply whether John Peter Zenger was guilty of printing and publishing the libels already mentioned. The jury were only out for a short time, and were soon back with their reply: not guilty. There was prolonged cheering, which Delancey tried to silence without effect. The following day, Zenger was discharged. He was regarded as something of a hero by his fellow citizens, and was made public printer of New York City. As to Cosby, he continued to be governor, but he drew in his horns and was seldom seen in public. The public rebuke was too much even for his thick skin. There were a few more libel trials that had real public significance, notably that of another radical journalist, William Cobbett, in June 1810 for publishing an account of rebellious English militiamen being flogged by German soldiers serving in the British Army. Cobbett, like Defoe, went to prison and also became a public hero in consequence. The lesson, then, would seem to be that a libel can be a weapon in the hands of a fighter for truth, but whether used in the service of truth or mere malice, it is always a treacherous and double-edged weapon that is best left in its sheath.